Simon Winchester is the best-selling author of The Professor and The Madman. In his new book, he tells the story of how he nearly lost his mind and his life. It is entitled The Man with the Electrified Brain, Adventures in Madness. Before the break, you were telling us about the therapy, about the electroshock therapy, and how six times and you were cured. What was happening in between those? Did you know at the beginning it was going to be six or that it would be a series? And were you free to go in between those?
I wasn't free to go. And in fact, I was so appalled by what had happened to me after the first session that I actually escaped. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing to think back. But I was in my pajamas. This is cold, wet spring day in the north of England. I climbed over the fence and walked. I remember a ploughed field. I mean, walking in bare feet in pajamas over a ploughed field on a early spring day is a pretty miserable experience to recount, and found my way into downtown Carlisle. I'm not quite sure where I thought I was going. I think I probably thought I was going back to my aunt's house, but I couldn't find it because I was in this bewildered state, and I must have looked absolutely a fright. You know, with bruises and wild hair and PJs and muddy feet, presumably. And eventually walked along the streets. I can't remember people looking at me or anything like that, but they must have done. And eventually felt completely exhausted. And they have, you probably see in things like Downton Abbey, outside great houses, a sort of steps leading downwards where they keep the garbage cans and where the servants come and go and the great people don't. So I went down those stairs and sheltered, it was raining now, among the garbage cans. And that's where the police found me a few hours later. And as it happens, so I think my wife was with the police, and the police started being sort of annoyed with me, sort of, and my wife, I remember waving her finger saying, "Don't, this man is ill. He doesn't need to be shouted at by the police." And they took me back to the hospital. And then I remained there. And I befriended a man who was much sicker than I was. I mean, he was very strange man, constantly pacing up and down, clearly very afflicted by all sorts of demons. And he and I would go walking in the gardens of the hospital. And I think through talking to him and having these treatments and the fact that as the treatments proceeded, I did actually get better. I developed an enormous empathy with people that are unwell. I mean, I think like many people, I had thought probably as my parents did, the mental illness is a figment of your imagination and that you can just snap out of it. But I realized with this chap that he couldn't, and nor could I. And it helped enormously. And I think I've retained a general sympathy, I think, for people that are mentally ill ever since.
I was fascinated reading the story because, as you described, that escape of just that sense of helplessness, because you were being treated, and yet, is this any way to live your life? Is this any way to feel as a result?
Yes, I was utterly bewildered. But the remarkable thing is that the doctors, despite everything I'd read about them, of course, about this hospital, they were tremendously compassionate, not just to me, but to all the other much more unwell people than I. And oddly enough, this came into play when I went to Broadmoor, the big criminal lunatic asylum where the hero, if you like, of this book, The Professor and the Madman, was incarcerated. These are people, very polar opposites of myself, well, not polar opposites, a different end of the spectrum, who had been mentally unwell and had committed terrible crimes. But they were being treated as patients with just the same degree of fascinated tenderness as I was. So, but to get back to my experience in Carlisle, the wonderful thing was that their tenderness and the electricity, for reasons which are still not widely understood, it did bring me back to good health again.
When you talk about it not being widely understood, especially given your scientific background, in the intervening years, it would seem to me that you would be at least very curious as to what the hell happened and what was wrong in the first place. What was it about that therapy that cured it? And am I sure it will never come back?
That's a wonderful question. Well, I became interested in it sort of scientifically when I was doing the research for The Professor and the Madman, because I needed to know what W.C. Minor was suffering from that made him do all these extraordinary things that, I mean, I won't go into them for people that haven't read the book, but basically this was a very, very mad fellow who murdered somebody in London and was then put in an asylum, Broadmoor, the one I just mentioned. But while there, did this remarkable work for the Oxford English Dictionary. I mean, an extraordinary person. What was wrong with him? Well, to find that out, I bought myself a copy of DSM-IV, this famous, some people infamous, manual, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Illnesses, Volume 4, which has just been replaced by DSM-5, which is about to come out very, very shortly, I think. Controversy over that as well. Which is fascinating reading anyway, but was fascinating in the context of The Professor and the Madman, because it was enabled me to say, just by looking and cross-referencing, that he was clearly a paranoid schizophrenic. So I thought, well, that was easy for him. What did I have? So I looked up my various symptoms that I've described, this feeling of unreality, incredible weariness, misery, bewilderment, detachment, and came up with a self-diagnosis that I was suffering from what's known as a fugue state, a dissociative fugue, that I was not myself and that I believed I was floating above myself and seeing myself in bizarre circumstances. Well, I've subsequently written to a professor at Stony Brook who is an expert on mood disorders, of which this was a classic example, and those ones that are amenable to treatment with electric shock therapy. And he says, that's all nonsense. You shouldn't. DSM-4 and DSM-5 are like sort of Chinese restaurant menus where it's so easy for overworked psychiatrists to say, these are your symptoms, therefore, let's have a look, page 372, you're suffering from X. X is an insurable ailment, so the insurance company will pay for it. Right. So that's what you've got. And it may have nothing to do with what you've actually got. Mm. He said, this chap Max Finck, said that what you definitely had was catatonic melancholia, which is produced largely by chemistry, by an adrenal complication, something that can, in the same way that you reboot a computer to produce a result which is sort of more experimental than logical, that's what you had. It's not listed in the book. If you went to a insurance company and said, I've got catatonic melancholia, they'd say, well, I'm sorry, it's not in the book, so we're not going to pay your medical bills. I mean, this is part of another discussion about the madness of the American health system, talking sure. about my madness. But he, Max Finck, and others now, because this little article of mine, or ebook, has actually made it into Psychology Today. And there's an article in the last week's issue saying, what was Simon Winchester really suffering from? And they want me to be the subject of a seminar where psychiatrists are going to sort of grill me and come up to their own conclusions of what was wrong with me.
Well, that sounds fun.
I know, exactly. Really, talk about courtroom drama. This will be amazing. But anyway, the short answer is that this enabled me to examine DSM-4 and to think sort of, or to come to some conclusions about whether electroconvulsive therapy it needs to be stigmatized. And of course, what stigmatized it was the treatment of Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the suicide of Ernest Hemingway, complications of Sylvia Plath and people like that, all of whom who have had and railed against and been badly affected by ECT.
Simon Winchester is our guest. The new book, The Man with the Electrified Brain, Adventures in Madness. It does give us a backstory, and I couldn't help but, in reading this story, think about The Professor and the Madmen, and think that one of the things that so often was said about that book, and I think why so many of us connected to it, was that even though you were writing about this madman, that there was an empathy for that character, for that man, and now that makes a lot more sense.
Yes, I don't think I thought that at the time. I mean, people would say, well, I mean, he's inherently fascinating. Someone who's in an asylum and who works right on the OED is obviously fascinating. But I think I really was deeply sympathetic to his problems and didn't find that he should be condemned necessarily for having picked up a gun and shot someone. Why do people do such strange things? Well, it makes sense to me, too, that yes, because I had suffered, as I say, a completely different end of the spectrum, but an illness which got me to behave in very peculiar ways, that it gave me some sense of, if you like, fellow feeling with someone like W.C. Minor.
You talk about electroshock therapy and the negative, the stigma that is around it, and it's dismissed pretty much, isn't it now? I mean,
no. In fact, I've had a lot of correspondence about it from people that have had it. One came just today. Someone here said he had 16 sessions, and what he was suffering from didn't come back for about 10 or 15 years, but then did come back, which of course gave me cause for concern whether it's actually cured me or merely postponed a problem. It's in some countries it is totally stigmatized. For instance, in India, it is banned. You cannot do it. In Britain, it's a sort of last ditch kind of treatment. And in this country, but as I mentioned, there are very few conditions that are listed in DSM-4 or presumably in 5, where an insurance company will say, this is the treatment.
Right.
Far better to have pills, and of course the pharmaceutical companies like that. But nowadays it's not nearly as brutal and barbaric and primitive as in my day. I mean, in my day, they gave you a pretty terrific shock. These days, the degree of the shock depends on, you know, your weight, your gender, maybe things like that, and the mental condition that you're suffering from. And so there's a sort of a gradual approach, and it's all rather, you know, I'm sure the electrodes are pink or something, and everything is sort of much more congenial. But in those days, it was pretty barbaric and brutal.
Do you think, or do you know, if you were to, God forbid, suffer from something like this again, because there was success the first time, that would be the treatment, or is there now a preferred treatment of this would be a regimen of drugs, a regimen of whatever that would go on as a replacement?
That's a very good question. It's something I almost don't like to think about. I dread. I mean, I still wake up thinking, could this come back?
Understood.
And it is so debilitating. I suspect that if it were to come back and I went to see a doctor, they would probably not prescribe it. Max Fink in Stony Brook would, but he's an elderly man. I mean, I think I'd ring him up, or at least when I had recovered from a session, and say, what do I do? But I just don't want to think about it coming back, frankly, Joe.
I understand that. And also, did you ever get to the bottom of why 9 days? Is there something in the body that is cyclical that would make that make sense?
It's something to do, they think, people like Max. I know I keep citing him, but he is an expert on it. That it is to do with the decay of the chemicals that are sort of accidentally introduced into your system through this adrenal failure. So yes, I mean, there is a chemical cause, and chemicals decay or react with other things in your bloodstream. That is one of the beliefs, but it so happens that many such, because of course I'm not the only person to suffer from this kind of thing, many people do have it for a limited and very regular amount of time, and always 5 days, or always 9 days, or always 7 days. 9 days is a long time, believe you me. If I'd had it for just 24 hours, I could have dealt with it more easily, but 9 days goes on and on.
I was curious also, and this is just more about the process than it is about the subject, and that is, because you have written, because you're a reporter and a journalist, what is it like to write about yourself then?
It's funny. I never have, and people have said, I mean, I'm now, 69, so people have said, oh, you know, you seem to have had an interesting life. Why don't you write an autobiography? And I thought, no, because the autobiography sort of marks the end. That's the full stop, isn't it? Or the closing parens.
Right.
So to do that would hasten my shuffling into the coffin, I think. But oddly enough, I found this a very interesting exercise. And I don't think I'll do it again for a while. I've got other books to write. But it's nice to know it's in reserve, because there are quite a lot of stories, none as sort of troubling as this one, but there's a lot to tell about, and yes, to write an autobiography someday seems rather more tempting as a result of this.
Without getting overly psychological, and maybe I'm barking up a wrong tree, but it seems, and having also lost my parents within the last few years, that when you try to examine something, and certainly in my life, thank goodness, not something as horrific as what you describe, but there is that want that I think we have when our parents are gone to ask questions and to help fill in the blanks of things that may give us answers. Did, even though there was that reserve that you mentioned and that British reserve with your parents, I assume there were questions that you would like to know about your history, even genetic history, that would help fill in some of those blanks.
Yes, my parents were, their story was a very peculiar story. Oddly enough, when I went to Buckingham Palace to get my an OBE from the Queen, when I took my mother to the palace, and this was in 2006, she had two glasses of sweet sherry, and which she normally never took, and became extremely vocal and told me stories about her life, which were unbelievable. I mean, involving espionage and affairs, and she didn't have any affairs, but people around her did, and the collapse of the Ramsay MacDonald government and all sorts of and things that ended up here in Hudson, New York, oddly enough. Mm-hmm. And then my father had... I knew more about his background because he was in prisoner of war camp. He was very badly treated. And so all sorts of aspects of their very, very complicated life, which only became apparent to me in the closing years of their life, left me wanting to say, I'm sure there's some spillover in your experiences or your genetic makeup that have resulted, well, obviously, you know, in the one child you produced, which was me. And but sadly, my father had a stroke and he was very unwell. We started to talk about things like this in the closing weeks, quite literally, of his life. And had he remained alive longer, and I'm pretty sure that he was becoming more tolerant and more accustomed to talking about, for instance, mental illness. But sadly, he passed away too soon. But it was coming to the surface, if you like, because of the stories of their lives that only came to the surface towards the end of their lives. I hope that doesn't sound too cumbersome as a sentence, but it was brimming. I could feel a sense of, this is all going to break, and then they died.
Is there a relief somewhat that the story is told now?
I think so, although it has wakened the thought. A number of people have said, it didn't cure you, it just put it off. And that troubles me from time to time. But I mean, it's been 6 months and I still seem fairly sane. So I think I'm all right. So yes, I think it has been a considerable relief.
The name of the book is The Man with the Electrified Brain, Adventures in Madness. It is from Byliner, and you can find out more by going to byliner.com, byliner.com to see the book, The Man with the Electrified Brain. Simon Winchester, it's always a pleasure to have you on this program. I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Thank you, Jeff.
Great pleasure. Again, it is The Man with the Electrified Brain, Adventures in Madness, published by Byliner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.